What does it take to make workshops work? And how can we facilitate collaboration that sticks and leads to results? My name is Miriam Hartness, and with the Workshops Work podcast, I am on the mission to find the magic ingredients that make workshops work. Today with me on the show is Stefan Dorn, and we speak about the challenges and opportunities of remote leadership and why this requires facilitation skills. So stay tuned. And by the way, if you don't have pen and paper at hand to take your own notes, scroll down to the show notes to download my free one-page summary. And now, enjoy. Hello, Stefan. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Miriam. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I am very curious where this conversation will lead us and bring us and what radical inclusion means, amongst other things. And before we get there, I always start with the same question. When did you start calling yourself a facilitator? And actually, do you?
I would say I identify as a facilitator. I rarely call myself that when people ask, what do you do? Because I find that most people don't really understand what that means. And then it just becomes awkward. You have to explain. And yeah, so I usually talk about the groups I work with, the things I do with them, more than saying I'm a facilitator. But it took me quite a while to understand that all the little different things that I'm doing, that actually at the core of it is facilitation. So, you know, training, parts coaching, parts consulting, parts just the traditional workshop facilitation as a skill and task, but all sort of comes together in this term facilitation. So that's why after 15 to 20 years, started to identify as a facilitator.
And I love this answer. And I think it's the first time I've heard that you would claim I identify myself as a facilitator, but I wouldn't call myself like that. And I can totally relate to the observation or the experience that people cannot really make sense of the term, and then it leads to more confusion than anything else.
And yeah,
this was actually the reason why I started with the podcast, because I started calling myself a facilitator. So I prepared my little pitch. I'm a facilitator. And everyone was like, what? Exactly. Coach? Are you a consultant? Are you a trainer? What are you?
Yeah. And if you know people in therapy circles, there are different modalities of alternative therapy who call themselves also facilitator. And it's sort of similar, but it's not the same. So then it creates even more confusion. So depending on where you are, it also has certain ideas attached to the word that are not necessarily what we would understand.
This is so true. And I think the most awkward situation I put myself in was at an ecstatic dance retreat. And people asked me, so other participants asked me, so what do you do? And I said, I'm a facilitator. Like, me too. And most of them were facilitators of either dance workshops or healing workshops,
exactly,
or spiritual journeys. And then to explain that, yes, but no.
Exactly. Yeah. So what they do is very similar. It's just that it's very focused on their therapeutic modality, right? Yeah.
Anyway. Interestingly, they use the same flow. They usually have the same priorities. So you start by creating a safe space. Everyone gets heard and seen, and you sit in a circle a lot. And still, it's so different. Yeah.
Yeah. It can be. I'm finding that in my work, at least, and with this experience of the last 3 years of the pandemic, a lot more of this, we need to accommodate what people come with is coming in sort of the traditional workshop facilitation as well. So I think people are realizing that a lot of people are on edge. There's a lot of tension there that people might have been able to, I'm sure it was there to some extent before as well, but the armors were working better. So I'm finding this comes in more and more that it becomes sort of it's not therapy, right? What we do, but that therapeutic element of welcoming in some of these things and giving space and slowing things down so people can actually calm down and be fully present with their minds as opposed to just reactive emotionally.
That's a very interesting observation. So that What I hear is that in our practice, we became more mindful of the circumstances of how participants are joining. And if I understand you correctly, that was triggered by the pandemic. Because for the first time, we acknowledged that everyone is facing this difficult situation and everyone has their own way to cope with it or their own difficulties with it. So suddenly we could call it in. Is this what you mean?
Yes. And it was okay to be called in. So I might have seen this before as well, because this is, you know, that people come with their issues and that they come with whatever is going on outside isn't new, right? That's partly why we do check-ins and warm-ups and things to have people settle in and leave whatever they have as issues outside of whatever it is that we want to focus on. But I think groups started to be more open and comfortable of bringing these things in, other than just saying, let's take 10 minutes to arrive and have a check-in and leave whatever isn't relevant for today outside, or tell each other if we are, you know, activated by something, depending on the group. But now all of a sudden, oh, let's have actually a little bit more space to talk about how it's going, how people are feeling. Very in the beginning of the pandemic, especially, you know, a lot of face-to-face stuff would shift online. So all of a sudden I would facilitate online workshops, meetings, project workshops, one every week almost. And they started to be slower than the typical one because of this. They started to be a bit more people appreciating that there's a time to breathe and that we didn't have to get to anywhere in the same time that we would usually want to get to.
Yeah.
Wherever it is the group decided to go, right?
So basically, not necessarily the facilitators who became more mindful, but the participants who became more mindful and more open to listen to each other, how they're feeling, where they're coming from, without labeling it woo-woo immediately.
Yes, definitely. And I think it gives me then the permission, and this is to continue doing that. Because I realized, oh, this is actually people welcome it to a certain extent and they like having that. And so now, even though a lot of, you know, we've sort of turned back the dial on a lot of things that we would do 2 years ago, dialed back to how it was before, but I find I've changed, right? I'm doing still things differently. So I'm looking much more at sort of the developmental processes of the group that I work with. I tend to like to work with a group more longer term as opposed to just doing one-off workshop. So when I have the opportunity to choose, which obviously we don't always have, I see how I'm drifting more to these sort of longer term developmental things than before, where I did a lot more of sort of one-off, a workshop here and a process there.
And it's interesting because I started online facilitation with the pandemic or because of the pandemic. So I don't have this before and after view.
Yeah.
And you made me just reflect whether I have actually changed back. And I haven't. I do realize that it takes more effort maybe or more design to help the participants arrive and really make the cut to slow down the pace because they're back in their routines and the high pace of before pandemic.
Not just back. I think it's accumulate. So maybe just to back up a little, I've been doing, you know, work with remote, hybrid, distributed teams since 2009. So I have a very good view of how that was before everybody worked from home for a couple of years. And I think the amount of meetings just has increased exponentially in those last years. There was a tendency of number of meetings augmenting, but not where people would have regularly. I hear now people having 8 hour days with 8 meetings of an hour each. And organizations are waking up to that. So there's more and more organizations that are telling people schedule for 15 minutes. So you have 10 minute breaks, but it's still very much in that sort of, we spend most of our day, 70-80% of our day in meetings.
Why do you think is that?
It's the immediate attention culture, maybe we can call it that, is that it's hard to shift to more of an asynchronous culture where I do things on my time and the other might have to wait a little. for my response. So I feel obliged to respond immediately, just as much as I expect the other to respond immediately. And so oftentimes the only way to do that is having a meeting, because then the other can't escape, right? Because, you know, we're talking now, so you have to respond to me now.
Yeah.
Whereas if I send you an email, you might ignore it for half the day. And I might have to send you a WhatsApp message, say, hey, I sent you an email, respond. And so you generate three or four notifications around one email. Whereas calling the person or saying, can we meet in an hour? You know, it's just one message and then we just talk and I have my stuff resolved.
Or not. And I wonder to what extent it's actually the illusion of productivity, right?
Yeah.
Because if we cannot resolve it, because sometimes we also need thinking time, and thinking together synchronously is difficult for some, especially if you're rather introverted or if you think to speak instead of speak to think.
Yeah.
And I somehow wonder whether there's also an element that it's difficult to for many to work alone.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're in an office space, then you have the accountability partners around you. So yes, you do your work, you're behind your screen, but it's a shared experience. And then in the home office, it's very difficult to find this accountability within yourself. So it's easier to have just a lot of meetings to enjoy this together time.
Yeah, that's a good point. Accountability is definitely one that I can see as well as very relevant. Yeah. How do we get there? Lots of meetings.
Yes.
So I agree. I mean, it's not about cutting all the meetings out, but it's also about learning that not everything has to happen in each. So what's the good middle point? And for some, it might be more meetings than for others, but you know, it's not either or. And then just getting better at doing them, right? I mean,
yeah, Joe Allen comes to my mind. He's a meeting researcher. So he's an academic doing research on meetings. And he said in an interview that the outcome of a bad meeting, more meetings.
Mm, definitely, yes.
Because you couldn't resolve or you couldn't discuss, and then you just schedule more meetings. And that's where facilitation comes in, right? That we actually need less of those.
Mm-hmm. And that's how facilitation also becomes this crucial skill for leaders now.
What do you mean by that?
One of the things that I'm observing is this, you know, with more and more technology, or with technology enabling more and more distributed and flexible work arrangements. So we are more and more part of different configurations of teams through project organization, through matrices, etc. We are separating our time more and more in different groups that we're working with. At the same time, decision making is so what that means is that more and more decisions are taken closer to where the action is.
Mm-hmm.
And so the leader now isn't the decider anymore, but the leader is really the person, you know, communicating or working, helping them work with constraints. So constraints that might come from the outside, from the environment of the team, and then communicating upwards, you know, whatever the results are that they're doing. And so they're becoming more and more the more facilitators of a collaboration process, rather than telling people what to do and deciding how things have to be done and what the results should look like.
Yeah, so less of a management, but in a different way.
Yeah, right. And so facilitation facilitating a meeting, a very, very simple thing, but then also coordinating across different people and working with them as a sort of larger facilitation task are two things that people really need to learn if they're leading in such an environment. And that environment is becoming more and more the norm, right?
Yeah. And then I like what you said about the constraints. So the leaders also making sure that there are boundaries, so protecting the team from unnecessary tasks, or making sure that the roles and responsibilities are distributed.
Yes, and also making sure that people don't do stuff that is outside of their area of influence or control, right? So if it's very clear that the budget is, you know, on some project is 10,000 and my team member has this idea of creating bells and whistles around the project that would cost it 20,000, then there's a constraint that I have to tell the guy, hey, or gal, you know, you have a limit here. You can't go beyond. So forget about some of these additional things that might be would be really nice.
Yeah.
There's still an authority figure needed, right? So you still need to exert authority in certain moments. It's not the facilitator that we might be who doesn't really take any decisions, but the you know has the group take the decisions. Mm-hmm. So I still might need to enforce certain things as a leader and have that sort of more traditional assertive leadership role. But I have to do it in a context where I facilitate longer term or shorter term processes amongst people. So I need to know when do I, you know, use my authority and when do I step back and let people do it.
And then the question is, does it need to be the leader's authority or can it be, again, this distributed peer responsibility or accountability where the facilitative leader could say, okay, this is our budget constraint. Considering every project's and bells and whistles, everyone wants to blow.
Exactly.
How we as a team or you as a team can actually come to a conclusion together.
Exactly. So the how can be be delegated to the team again. Yes.
And then definitely. I wonder to what extent, and since you work with leaders a lot, I wonder to what extent there is an impact on the ego of leaders with this shift in responsibilities, because you said before that now organizations try decision to be taken at the lowest level, so where the action is. So there's more distributed decision making as well. So if the leaders now turn into facilitators, where people like us, facilitators, go like, hooray, finally they understand it.
Yeah, exactly.
Leaders might think, what the heck? I thought that I'm this authoritative figure. I'm taking decisions. I'm telling people where to go. And now they want me to be the person sitting in a circle and asking everyone how they feel.
Exactly. The famous touchy-feely. I'm sure there's something like that happening. So I heard the other day, it was a discussion around why are all these executives calling their teams back into the office? And then somebody was saying, oh, it's because otherwise, they have nobody to show off their Armani suits and expensive watches and show off that they're in a corner office, right? So I'm sure that at some level, that's happening as well. What I think is more common is that a lot of managers, leaders, leaders, executives don't really know how to do this new way. Right. So they're lost to the extent that they realize then there's a new way they need to do things. They don't have necessarily the skills and abilities developed. They don't have the experience doing it. But they also see that the other doesn't work anymore.
Mm.
Right. I get a lot of resistance. When I do my old style, I just get resistance from people. Mm-hmm. And now that they are actually far away from me, it's easy for them to ignore me. Right. Before, I could just get up and go to the desk and then the person couldn't ignore me anymore. Now, if they're working from home, then, you know, how am I going to do that? If they ignore my email, they ignore my email. I can't really do anything. And because I'm probably not the only boss, you know, new ways of organizing, they have a perfect, you know, they can just say I was doing stuff for the other project. I couldn't respond. Right. Mm-hmm. I was meeting. And how am I going to, you know, check that?
Yeah.
So all of a sudden, my old way doesn't work anymore. I don't really know how to do the new way yet. And I'm lost in the middle, right? Sort of this typical sort of depression point.
Yeah.
Where.
True. And then,
so I think that's mm-hmm. much more the case than sort of people being sad about losing their whatever feeds their ego, their status. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you for bringing up the example of many people now working for different. Or reporting to different individuals and leaders. And I wonder then, because then they cannot control without slipping into the role of a micromanager.
Mm.
So it must be trust-based. But then where is the trust coming from if there are no facilitation skills or if even the definition of what a team is becoming more fluid? And I wonder then, whether the problem lies in promoting the wrong people to leaders or not equipped
equipping them with the actual tools. Because I think what we have observed, or maybe still observe, is that those who have subject matter expertise and competences, they get promoted into leadership position.
Mm-hmm.
But this is exactly where they don't need necessarily the subject matter expertise, but all these other competencies. So are organizations then promoting the wrong people?
I mean, I wouldn't go as far as judging that all organizations are promoting always the wrong people. But I think this pattern that you describe is definitely true. Is that you're an expert in your area, so you become visible and known in your market, and therefore you hold sort of this authority that then makes you become the prime candidate for manager, let's say. I do think that a lot of organizations have realized that, or even, not recently, but that's why you have all these leadership programs in most companies. Whether they are effective or not is another story. And I think what happened until about maybe 5-6 years ago is that even though they were taught in leadership trainings and management trainings that they needed to lead differently, the old model was still working, right? The micromanager model was still working to some extent because the people were in the office together. They couldn't really run away. So they just had to endure the boss the way he was, and the results were right. So nobody really cared. Now we're looking at a situation where things are so distributed and so networked that model just doesn't work anymore for a lot of leaders. It's still, and unfortunately, it still works for many. That's why it still persists. But for more and more people, it just doesn't work anymore. And now all of a sudden, all these lessons that leadership gurus have been telling the world for, 30 years, this is not new, right? Group dynamics is from the 60s or something. Yeah, we collectively realize, now we need to actually do it.
Yeah.
Because if we don't, people just disappear into distance, right?
Yeah.
I wanted to comment on one thing that you said earlier is that, the only way is micromanagement, but and the other thing is trust. Is this, how do we actually build connection in this new world? And I think that's a very crucial question beyond sort of having facilitation abilities and skills, is this interpersonal, being able to build and maintain relationships. It's becoming really, really...
So how can we?
The key. Well, it's very much, I think it goes a little bit to what I mentioned in the beginning, what we talked a little bit about in terms of individual needs and stress factors coming into our meetings and into our workshops. And it's acknowledging that, we all have different contexts we're in, even more so than before, because before the work context was one, right? Everybody in the same location, in the same office. So subject to the same weather, subject to the same traffic jams, subject to the same good or bad food of the cafeteria. So the only things that were creeping in was, I have, issues at home, or my kid's sick, or whatever. But other than that, we're in the same little world. And now all of a sudden, we're not anymore. We're in all these different locations. So the individual experience is becoming so much more diverse.
Yeah.
Or the sum of the individual experiences is becoming so much more diverse.
Yeah, and then it starts with acknowledging that the individual experience matters for the collective experience and the outcome of a group conversation.
Yes. So when we facilitate with my colleagues, when we facilitate team development processes for remote teams, we always start at sort of an individual reflection. What works? What doesn't work for me? How is my context? What can be expected from me in what situation? How am I available? How do I like to communicate? Is it more in writing, more in talking? What stresses me? How do I react to stress? How can people tell when I'm on the edge, right? And when maybe they should beware of, whatever's going on. It has to start there, but then it can't stop there, obviously, because if we stop at, this is my reality, now everybody has to do what I like, we're never going to get to anywhere, because probably these interests are going to shock, right?
Yeah.
If I want to do everything in writing and you want to do everything in talking, there we have a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to find an agreement. So yeah, so start from what is it that works, what is it that works for me best, but then facilitate a conversation to try and find agreement of what could work as a group.
Yeah, just as in every relationship.
Exactly. And that process already teaches how to build connection and yeah. deepen it over time, because it shows you how, you know, when you engage in these conversations, all of a sudden you see it's not set in stone and that people are flexible and there is an understanding that certain things are more difficult than others. So, you know, this person has a situation where they can't really adapt, so I can adapt.
And isn't it funny that the moment we enable participants, team members to glimpse into each other's humanity. Mm. So the vulnerability of just being a normal human being suddenly opens up opportunities to find agreement and to meet mm. at a different level. Where in the beginning, everyone says, I want everything in writing. I want everything in real time. No, no, no. And then I loved what you said, where you explore, how do I react when I'm stressed? How does it manifest? What do mm-hmm. we see from each other in different situations? This, I think, opens the box to realize, oh, we all have these bad days.
Yeah. And we all have our ways of dealing with those bad mm-hmm. days, right? Some people just shut down and retreat, and other people just start attacking, right? They'll become really aggressive. And so knowing, or and others might try to please. So, you know, let me just make everything harmonious so that awkward feeling goes away. And so knowing some of these patterns really helps you to first understand, okay, this person is now in their, you know, they're clearly stressed. And maybe I can tell them, hey, you know, it's not that important. Let's meet again next week, or let's have a think about it. But I also don't have to become reactive just because they've become reactive, right? Very often your stress triggers mine, right?
Yes. Yeah. Because we take it personally.
Yeah, exactly.
Because if you're stressed and then maybe you withdraw. Mm-hmm. So you're the kind of person who doesn't speak because you're stressed. And then I take it personally. I think you withdraw from me. So I yeah. might have these anxiety attacks that I did something wrong. And exactly. once we have clarity or transparency about that, we can discuss it and actually find solutions.
Yeah.
Yeah, making the implicit explicit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. But obviously that doesn't, you know, it's not that like you make a list of everything, because very often people aren't even aware of some of these things for themselves. So it's a process that can take. So you start with some simple things of that people are aware of. Oh yeah, I really prefer to start with the big picture as opposed to the details, where somebody else might say, no, give me all the details because, you know, that really helps me, or I like writing as opposed to talking or whatever. And then you help them repeat that and go deeper and deeper as they go.
How do you help teams, remote teams, then to work better together if you have these extreme differences and preferences? Because at the end of the day, there's no right or wrong here. It's not like taking a team decision on the strategy where then everyone has to align. It's if I do need this to work at my best, how do I find a compromise across the team? How do you facilitate this process? Maybe I have a hack.
Not really. So a lot of facilitation models use this sort of, you know, you let people think alone, have them interact in small, more intimate groups, and then bring everybody together. So we call that me, we, us. I think there's tons of different variations of this. And that same process can be used here. So me would be, what is it that works for me, helping people reflect on their preferences, etc. And then in the we part, so where you just have different configurations of people sharing, and starting to understand where is there actually a problem? Where is there actually the need for an agreement? Because a lot of these things, people are more or less aligned, right? I mean, they've been working together already. They know how it's working to some extent. Mm-hmm. So the first part is to identifying where is it that actually the issue is. Where does the shoe, how do you say that in English?
The pebble in the shoe. German. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Der Schuh drückt.
Exactly. And so that's the first step. And then once you have identified them, it's also not to find a solution that then everyone has to follow. So that's why I think the team level is so crucial, and is to understand what is actually the team. Because very often we talk about teams and we talk about everyone from HR, 40, 50 people in a global company. And now all of a sudden they have to do everything the same way, even though that I don't interact with 35 of those 40 people, right? I only interact with 5 of them. So I actually only need an agreement with those 5 that I'm working with daily. If I'm working on payroll, I don't necessarily need to have an agreement with somebody who coordinates trainings in the company, right? Because there's very little interaction. And so it's really figuring out in the day-to-day, where's the machine clogged? And then what are the people that I actually need to have agreements with? So this can be a very decentralized process as well, where you don't need to have, now for everyone, this has to be this way, but this group does it one way, the other group does it another. This group has more meetings than that group because, you know, those are the types of people. And usually cultures are, you know, it's not that we're working in a void, right? Very rarely are we doing this kind of stuff in a new meeting where there's no experience whatsoever, where there's no context that people have been exposed to before. I've actually never had that. So even if it's a new team, they are in an established organization where there is a culture. So there are certain things that they're already doing in a similar way. Right? Yeah. So in practice, actually just facilitating those conversations is often enough. They'll figure it out. It's like, trust the process, right?
I love that. And trust that they know what they're doing and then they know what they need. And then it's just removing some obstacles and giving them the right prompts.
And the second part to it is making sure that they review whatever is that they agreed on. Right. So building in sort of a learning element over time is just, you know, this is not something that's set in stone. I think people can relax into an agreement that may not be the ideal for them if they know it's just for a month and then we'll review it. And if it's really that bad that I fear it'll be, then I can say this is bad. We need to change it.
Yeah.
Right.
And so, I wonder how easy or difficult it is for teams to adopt the mindset of good enough, because that's what I hear, right? So this agreement is good enough for now. Let's roll with it.
In practice, I think it's very easy for them, because usually the trouble is getting them to spend the time to actually have those discussions in the first place.
Yeah.
Because oftentimes they will just say, it works sort of, you know, half the people are unhappy, but it works. So why do we spend this time having thinking about, you know, nobody likes individual reflections anyway, right? I mean, you have to think about myself. And so there's, I mean, you know, even those of us who love, you know, sort of self-development, etc. I know I have resistance when somebody comes and says, now do this exercise. You know, the parts of me that don't want to change, they come up and they say, don't, you know, procrastinate on it. So it's normal that those, you know, that happens. And so the resistance I find is much more in getting people to actually spend the time, invest the time in this initial process, rather than working out, agreeing to something that might not be ideal. And because there is no ideal, right? I mean, we're talking about different interests. So bringing different interests together, if I'm trying to please everyone, I'm probably not going to get a very good result.
I also see how difficult it is to help them understand the benefits, because this rather simple exercise, which takes what, maybe an hour, rather 2 hours, how much impact in terms of time saved, misalignment, conflict, all of these small hurdles and obstacles that accumulate over time in teamwork, they will all dissolve as a direct result of this activity. But how can you help a team imagine the outcome?
Good question. For me, that's one of the biggest challenges. You know, as a person looking at it from the outside, it's always much easier to see the potential, right? Because you're not tainted by how things are being done right now. There's no routines there for me when I look at what they're doing. But for them, it's habitual, right? So it's really hard not to do how they're doing it right now. And so I find that's the most difficult part, partly in remote work. That's one of the things that I think has shifted in the last few years is what in the last couple of years is what we always faced is that people didn't really have a notion of what was possible remotely. Because basically what they were doing is they were using Zoom or Teams as a better phone service, right? Mm-hmm. So they were doing conference calls with video and chat, and that's it. But very few would experiment with all the other things you can do in there, right? Or forget about adding another tool and having something visual on a whiteboard or something like that. So that's changed thanks to the work from home experiment. Is people realize that you're just doing conference calls isn't really enough, and we can experiment with the possibilities we have, but there's still a lack of really knowing what's possible in part, and then there's this sort of but now I have to learn how to do this differently, and I have to have sort of discipline of not falling back into my old habits, and so that's where I think the biggest challenge is. I find as a person facilitating these processes for teams.
Yeah. And also the human capacity to imagine that someone is able to change and the impact this can have. Yeah. Because I think if you're always running in the same conflict, or you're annoyed by a colleague, but they're always so focused on the details and they always speak so much. Then not being able to envision or to visualize how it could be different.
Yeah, I can see that as well. As I almost think that the wider context that we live in is this sort of nothing's going to change anyway. Yeah. We're doing all these things to become more sustainable, and it's not going to change anyway. Where we're using all this tech, but in the end, they're calling me back to the office. It's sort of almost like a. The collective energy is also not believing that things can be better.
Or at least not on the micro level. It reminds me of this saying that we tend to underestimate what we can do in a year and 10 years, and we overestimate what we can do in a day or an hour.
Yes.
And I have the impression that the same is true with change. We underestimate what can actually change on the micro level. And we might overestimate what can change on the macro level. So now everyone's speaking of AI and what AI will be able to do, but totally neglecting what we are able to do on the very small level of the team.
And also even imagining that we have agency in this, right? Mm-hmm. So I think AI is a great example of where basically the main story that we read about every day and that is told and retold is, that's the future, and this is how it's going to be. Why? Why does it have to be that way? Why can't we imagine how we would like to use this technology and shape it to, how we want it to help us, as opposed to accepting that, these 20 professions are going to go away and we're basically going to be giving an idea to AI and then AI does the rest is sort of what I understand the current story to be.
Yeah. And then again, facilitation comes into the game to help them imagine. Because I listened to a podcast recently and I loved what, was it Naval? I'm not sure. What they were saying about, we cannot imagine what future professions will emerge. So
yeah.
5 years ago or 10 years ago, nobody would have ever thought that playing video games can be a profession, right? Or commenting on people who play video games live would be a profession. Yeah.
Just like the dread of every parent from 50 years ago was for the kid to say, I'm going to be an artist. Now I think parents are I'm going to be a gamer, and they go, oh.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's easy to complain or to say, all our jobs will disappear, but it's very difficult. Or it can be exciting to think what kind of jobs will appear.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I fully agree that facilitation and us as the people promoting and doing facilitation have a huge job in helping people imagine that some other things are possible.
And that they have agency, as you said.
And that they have agency, exactly, that they can actually pick something that they want to create and actually do create it, that it's not in vain to imagine something.
What I just realized is I think many of us facilitators underestimate this impact, this to empower, enable this change of perspective of recognizing, acknowledging agency, and what kind of energy boost this can actually bring to an organization.
Yes.
Your companies, I would shift the conversation to a slightly different, if that's
go ahead.
Yeah. Your company's name is Radical Inclusion. Mm-hmm. What does that mean?
I think in the beginning, it was two things. When we came up with the name, it was a cool name, and it was an expression of the things that we as a group value. So to make a statement of saying, you know, including as many people as possible in a decision, in a process, is beneficial. Mm. Not everybody and their dog, but the people who are affected by a certain process or decision and who can affect a certain process and decision. And implicit in that is this agency discussion, right? Is that there's a balance of power or a re-equilibrium of power that has to happen. So it's not the usual suspects who decide something, but it's a wider group who has to actually engage with one another. And I think we're back to this process of how do you facilitate agreements on a team level. It's a very similar process. So before, at the company level or at the team lead level, somebody would say, this is how we do it, period. Mm-hmm. And now we're saying, you know, maybe you need to understand where your people are coming from and have them decide together with you, obviously, but not just you, how to do it. So for me, that's the expression of, that's what radical inclusion stands for. At the same time, we were talking about, you know, how my facilitation processes are becoming more and more, or I'm becoming more and more aware of what individuals are bringing to the process. So this whole diversity, inclusion, equity discussion is coming more into my field of awareness and how it shapes how I work. And so interestingly, radical inclusion is a term that very well fits in that as well, right? Mm. Even though it was really more about how can we create processes where as many of the people who need to be involved can be heard. So very much from a sort of open space system in the room type point of view, right? What's the system and who has to be in the room for this to be a long-lasting inclusive decision that this group is going to, or this process is going to take?
Yeah, because if the people who are affected are not included in the process, it won't be sustainable.
Very often.
And before coming to the diversity, equity, inclusion part, because I think that's also very interesting, what makes inclusion then radical? Or what's the radical part? Or is it just a provocation?
I think it's more of a provocation, yes. Mm-hmm. It's not that you have, again, I don't think it's that you have to include everyone in everything. It's also not feasible, right? Yeah, also, exactly. So just like I said before, if you are facilitating an agreement among people, how are we going to be available for one another in our little remote team? It's the five people who work together daily that are affected and that need to have this conversation together, and not the parallel team who might, you know, want to do things differently. There might be a point of sharing then afterwards of how others are doing it so we can learn from it. And that's another level of inclusivity, I guess. But yeah, so radical is really more of a provocation to what's normal now.
Mm, yeah, because as you just spoke, I was wondering whether radical exclusion could fit as well. Because if we think of this core team of five instead of the entire group of HR, then yes, it's radical inclusion when you look at the team of five. And when you look at the entire HR department, it's a radical exclusion, which is highly effective.
Yeah, probably. It's similar to prioritization, right? It's saying no becomes a really important thing to be able to do, because otherwise you're not going to be able to focus at all. So, yeah.
Yeah, and then to have the conversation actually in a, I loved what you said in the earlier part of our conversation about the team and the group. So who's actually part of the core team? And I wondered to what extent many challenges or problems on the team level actually happen because nobody has ever sat down to define what the team is, especially in this world that you described where people might report to different leaders and work with different teams. Yes. And then to set the boundary and say, okay, this is the team and this is not the team.
Right. Yeah. And I think traditionally it was normal to be part of a team, and the team was sort of a standing long-term team that was together for several years, obviously with the turnover that you have in any company, but you would work with the same colleagues over a period of time, and you would basically exclusively work with them, right? Mm-hmm. And so this is becoming more and more fuzzy to the point that I think a lot of people aren't really in any stable teams anymore. So they might have a couple of people they interact with a lot because they're in the same project, they end up in the same projects or whatever, but it's not the, sort of this traditional definition of a team that works towards a joint goal, right? Mm-hmm. And that has sort of this regular interaction, which then makes it worthwhile investing in team development, team building, and all these kinds of things because they pay off over time. Mm-hmm. And now a lot of times I'm in this project, you know, 2-3 month project, especially agile organizations, I think, are very fluid in that. And the question then is it actually worth spending a few hours in the beginning to align when, you know, in a month we have to do it again? So that's actually one of the arguments that's coming up quite a bit when we're talking about how can we become better as teams or as groups of people working together. Maybe we should call it that. To what extent is this fuzziness undermining sort of a long-term efficiency or effectiveness?
And it's two things come to my mind. One is the concept of slowing down to speed up. So slowing down in the beginning to actually becoming a team then speeds up everything that comes after.
Yeah.
And the other thing that comes to my mind are teams that in emergency situations, if there's an emergency and then you have these teams of experts in a crisis, and I would think that they do some work to becoming a team in the beginning so that they can actually leverage each other and be fast, effective in communication.
Yes. I mean, I think part of it is also in organizations that have that a lot, there's also standardization, right? So, So I know that there's a certain way of doing things when I come into these situations. And there is certainly work on figuring out how this, you know, the typical team development cycle applies there as well, where there's a sort of forming phase where we try to figure out how we do things together, and there'll be clashes where things aren't working, and so we're working them out through constructive conflict, etc. But I also think, and I think we've seen that in the beginning of the lockdowns as well, is that we compartmentalize, right? So the stuff that isn't really ideal, mm-hmm. we just put to the side and say, ah, for a couple of weeks, it'll be fine. And I'll just accept it. And mm-hmm. I'll put on my armor and I'll do it the way that everybody does it because we don't have time to discuss this now. And so that's part of this emotional reactivity seeping in to work, I think, because if you have to sustain that over a long time, eventually it'll just come up. Eventually, mm-hmm. I'll just be really full of resentment and annoyed and frustrated that, you know, it's now half a year that we're doing this and it's still really annoying and it doesn't work. And I'm, you know, done pretending it's okay.
This is actually a fascinating challenge because it basically means that you have to invest time and resources in this continuous development or even solving conflicts that aren't hot yet to avoid the wrong team then to be affected. Because if it boils up, if it accumulates in me that I'm constantly frustrated, yeah. For sure it will be the wrong team. Right?
Right. Yeah. So this other team bothered me for 3 months and now I'm letting it out on you, right? Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
Because yeah. Yeah.
And then
definitely.
Basically the continuous team development in different setups becomes something like a public good or a public investment, a common good that the organization has to invest in.
And that's still, and I think that's, you know, letting it out on my colleagues is not nice, but for me, it's still healthier than eating
sucking it up.
Sucking it up and just ignoring it and putting it inside. And I think the rise in mental health issues, et cetera, for me, it very much connects to some of this is that, you know, we've just been having to deal with a really, really frustrating situation that obviously, companies, you know, the origin of which isn't coming from the companies, but some of the reactions they've had to this weren't necessarily the best.
So basically then to avoid everyone to become a pressure cooker.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. Yeah, definitely.
And then the solution is to learn how to deal with this conflict or because to let it out on, there are different ways to let it out on our colleagues, right? And we can replace colleagues with partner, children, friends.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. We take it home. We take it to our friend circles. Yeah. Yeah. So I think back to the beginning of our conversation, I think that that's where people are starting to see the value of slowing down, of having space to talk about some of these things. Very early on in the pandemic, there was a great process facilitated by this group called SY Partners. I forget the name, but basically what they did is they offered a space for people to just vent and be there. And so one of the exercises in the first gathering was the great vent. So people would just put whatever it is that was frustrating them in the chat. And you'd have like 900 people participating and everybody sort of putting, this person is annoying and that is happening. And you could literally feel how the tension in the group was sort of going out, you know, like leaving. And so having these kinds of exercises can be very therapeutic. You just have to do it in a way that it's not people attacking each other, right? But that it's giving people an outlet and then facilitating how, you know, how can we not let it build up again?
Mm. Yeah.
So it's not just, you know, every 3 months we just let it all out. It's also not helpful, right?
Especially because for some of the frustrations, there might be, so sometimes we're just frustrated and we need to vent. And other times there's a reason why we are frustrated. And then I think if we are asked to vent every 3 months, but nobody's actually interested in the origins or changing something about it, I think very soon the pressure cooker will explode. Because exactly. Then it's also a sign that we're not taken seriously.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's like you're doing doing a parking lot and then never looking at it in a meeting, right? So you have this parking lot flip chart where people are putting stuff that isn't relevant to what we're discussing now, and then we just ignore it and leave it there.
Which I think is not a good idea. Is the default of most of the workshops.
Yeah.
What do you do with the parking lot?
If there's no time in the actual meeting, then we would task somebody to from the group to take it up and go through it and see what has to be resolved by whom to schedule, you know, other processes afterwards or whatever it is. But that's the very least I think you need to do is sort of, you know, not just put it there, but acknowledge it's there and understand you need to do something with it. Right.
Yeah.
And very often people will say, I put it there, but it's really, you know, the discussion sort of resolved it already.
Yeah. And So in the best of all worlds, there is time at the end. Oh, now we're finished on time before the time. Exactly. Let's have a look at the parking lot. In reality, there is never enough time. And then obviously everything that we've parked wasn't relevant. And I think I don't remember who it was. Maybe it was Thomas Lantaler on LinkedIn who wrote an entire post. Well, we should stop having parking lots.
Parking lots.
It's hypocritical anyway.
Yeah.
And I think there's some wisdom or some truth to that. And I like the pragmatic solution of just assigning someone the role.
Well, you know, it also depends on the meeting. Sometimes it makes sense, sometimes it doesn't to have a parking lot. So it's not, I don't think these things have to be rules. But very often people will, you know, it's interesting how participants have certain things in their heads about what facilitation involves.
Mm-hmm.
And so parking lot is one of these things that everybody remembers from you know, their past experiences. And so we're not going to have a parking lot. I actually hear that quite often. Is so, oh, we can create a parking lot.
I wonder, sorry to interrupt.
It's an image that people, that's very, very easy for people to
remember. And I wonder whether it wouldn't make sense to, or whether the parking lot is the excuse of not being able to say no. So what is it that as facilitators, we cannot say, okay, this is a nice idea, but it has nothing to do with the workshop or with the reason or the purpose we are here together now. If it's important to you, bring it up another time. But that's your responsibility. It's not our shared responsibility. And it's not for the parking lot.
Exactly. Yes, definitely. And the other thing that I think happens a lot with it's sort of in the name of efficiency, we're avoiding the uncomfortable discussion. Mm. So let's put it on the parking lot so we don't have to deal with it now.
Which is even more dangerous.
Exactly. And I think, I mean, that's core facilitator business to then say, no, we're not going to put it on the parking lot. We're going to discuss this now. Yeah. Because it is very relevant and it is actually at the core of what you're trying to avoid as a group.
Yeah.
So, yes. So,
and as you say, that's definitely core facilitation work to distinguish the relevant from the irrelevant.
I really like this image of one of the, when I did facilitation training. So when I learned how to facilitate in the trainings that I did with a guy called Sam Kaner, and the typical diamond model that you probably know as well, divergence, convergence, right? And what was unique about his model, at least for me at the time, was that in the middle, he would put what he called the groan zone.
Mm.
So where the integration happens, right? Where you actually, you deal with all the divergent ideas that are on the table. And he would repeat over and over, make sure, you know, keep people in the groan zone as long as possible. Mm. That's your main job. You know, don't let them go the easy way and have convergence too fast.
Yeah.
Because they're going to lose the ideas. They're going to not really talk about the stuff they need to talk about. Several people are not going to be happy with the result. But the group will have the tendency to close fast because it's just uncomfortable to be in that middle zone.
Yeah, the uncertainty.
And so when I say, exactly. So when I say our core business is, that's what I'm referring to, right? Mm-hmm. Is keep people where they're as a group, they can grow the most, which is usually not a very comfortable place for them, nor is it for us necessarily, but more for them.
Yeah, that's the reason why they hire us.
Exactly.
According to you, what makes a workshop fail?
I'm not sure a workshop can, I mean, you can have bad progress and process and, you know, not get anything done. But aside from bad preparation, bad process that, you know, you might do without much experience, I don't think there's a failure when you don't reach results. It's really about what can we learn from this, from the facilitator's point of view, but as well as the participant's point of view is, so things have gone that way and we haven't reached our objective. Why is that, right? That I think the important thing is to have that reflection. So failure would probably be not to reflect on why things haven't worked the way they did. They did.
Like that.
They were supposed to.
Yeah.
And I think it's hard as a new facilitator to sustain that because you need to sort of say, hey, you know, there was nothing wrong with my facilitation. The dynamic was such that, right? And get your client or your group to reflect on that as opposed to them blaming you, which, you know, in the beginning, to me at least, happened quite a bit, is that we didn't reach the objective. It's the fault of the facilitator. And in some instances, it's okay to be, you know, to take the blame if it helps the group. But it's recognizing that, you know, it's oftentimes there was nothing you could have done differently that would have led to a different outcome.
Yeah.
Because, you know, that's just the discussion they had to have.
Yeah. And I thank you for the reminder also about the responsibility. It's not so the quality of the outcome and to some extent the outcome itself, it's not our responsibility. And then, who are we to judge anyway?
And that's probably the hardest sell you have to make as a facilitator, right? To yourself in the beginning, especially, that you want to satisfy your clients, so you want to reach their objectives, but realizing that, you know, that's not what you're there for, because otherwise you're taking away their agency.
Yeah.
We're back to agency.
And that's difficult to sell, because everyone wants to buy certainty, wants to buy results.
I think they want to have somebody to give the responsibility to,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. And I guess that's why it's still easier and more expensive to sell consulting services than facilitation services. Because
especially if you're doing McKinsey model,
yes,
consulting.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Because there's a guarantee in an outcome. You will have a slide deck with some results and three priorities that you can implement.
Exactly. And then, but then you're not getting involved in the implementation. So,
yeah.
In the pure model.
Exactly. Which somehow leads us back. There was still something that I put in a parking lot in our conversation. And I hope that we have time to at least touch the surface, which is the implication of DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion in the radical inclusion model.
So I don't do full DEI work. So I'm not a diversity, equity, inclusion specialist nor consultant. I've done a little bit of dipping my toe into the issues. And as a facilitator, I think there is a certain awareness of, you know, individual differences coming in and understanding how people are affected by whatever integration happens or doesn't happen. What I'm finding in, especially in team development processes, the topic of identity, so identity as a BIPOC or as LGBTQ plus or as rich or poor, people are more outspoken or more clear about that they hold a certain identity and what that means for them. So when I think before, this was just sort of a private matter that that I wasn't going to share necessarily with my colleagues. Now it's something that I take into other spheres of my life. And so it becomes a topic. And other things where the influence is more collective, I find they're becoming less relevant. So national culture, for example, is one where before you had sort of quite homogenous groups working together, and then you had the odd foreigner coming in, learning about, you know, I'm an expat in India, and now I need to learn how things are, you know, how Indians communicate, etc., which already is quite a thing to say Indians, because, you know, regions are quite different. But so there was this, you know, I can learn about a certain national culture and how they communicate and how they understand authority and how they deal with time, etc. And that can help me be more effective and less confrontational in those contexts. But now, you know, most teams are international. You have these things of individual identity coming in. You have different work preferences coming in. You have all these different contexts of somebody wants to go to the office to work heads down and concentrated, and another person wants to go to the office to socialize with colleagues. And so the biggest lesson for me with all these different pieces coming in as active influencers of how groups work together is that you need to start at the individual level and understand who is it that's actually here in the group and what are their preferences and how do they see the world? What are the beliefs they hold about, you know, certain different things? So what some of the most interesting discussions I've had with leadership teams is starting to talk about, what do you actually believe about remote work? Is it better or worse? Do we get more done in the office? So challenging these kinds of things and share, having them share and see how often there's not a unified view of one is good, one is bad, but that they're actually having very different views on things, even though that's not a good example for inclusion, diversity. Generally, these kinds of teams are very homogenous.
And still it is a good example, because it also a simple question like that reveals then the biases and the blind spots. So we don't even have to look at the hairy things, the politically or socially more sensitive topics. Mm-hmm. In order to realize that.
I just wanted to add one more thing on the diversity, inclusion, equity topic. And that is that a lot of times when people communicate openly their identities and what that means for them, they're strongly attached to trauma. And so we talked about emotional reactivity already. So in this case, it's not just stress, but it's me being triggered in a collective trauma response, right? I might, you know, a Black colleague might be reacting to a certain joke in a certain way because that just triggers for him. It's a racist trigger, and that triggers a certain response from him that the team needs to understand, sometimes accommodate or hopefully accommodate, and figure out how to work with in this group context.
Yeah. And this is a very important point you're making, which also relates to the disclaimer you made at the beginning that you're not a specialist in the DEI work, because what I understand is specializing or promoting the DEI work also means that we have to be specialists, or at least to know how the trauma-informed facilitation style.
Yeah, the pie sort of grows as we get deeper into the topics, and human relationships are this bottomless pit where, you know, you can always go deeper.
Yeah.
But there are certain things that I think are just coming up more and more frequently and are becoming more and more defining of successful teamwork than they used to.
Yeah, acknowledging
even normal facilitators, need to be able to recognize those behaviors, those patterns, and probably in some cases also recognize that, you know, this goes beyond what I can actually work with.
Yeah.
So because I don't know enough about different identities, or because I don't know enough about how to deal with the trauma that's coming up there.
Yeah. And then to acknowledge it. And I think what you mentioned, to acknowledge the importance of starting at the individual level. And I think this is something that where as facilitators, there's also a lot of educative work we have to do towards clients who hire us, who often want to get to actions, to results, to the team level immediately. And they forget how important it is and how important it became to start at the individual level.
Yeah, I think it relates again to the grown zone, right? It's uncomfortable to have to deal with so much diversity, and so let's just skip it. I think we all have that tendency to.
I think it's very human
to try, yeah.
Yeah, to deal with someone
who's complex, different from us. Complex, yeah. And messy, right? And complex and messy is always difficult.
And we don't understand. And I think our generation, at least, we grew up with the golden rule, treat others the way you want to be treated yourself, and then everything is fine. And nowadays, we learn that this is not enough. We need to treat people how they want to be treated.
Right? Exactly.
And I think that's a big shift for many, because it's basically a rupture in our belief system and how we were raised. And I think also acknowledging that it's difficult is also okay. Diversity is difficult to be confronted with other opinions.
And that's where the connection is, right? This is when I can look over the rim of my cup and start to open myself to see what's in the cup of the other. That's when I build deeper relationships. That's when I create connection, and then trust results. And all of a sudden, you know, we can all feel safe with one another and work together so much better.
Which brings us back full circle to where we started, taking time to explore everyone's reality of what is present in the moment, to have a shared humanity.
Yeah. And I think one of the things that we touched a little bit upon, but didn't really go deeper, is this idea of, so how much do you invest in this type of a process when the people that I'm working with aren't really the same in a month from now? And I think the beauty about starting with an individual reflection is that individual reflection serves me beyond whoever, you know, it doesn't matter who I'm working with afterwards. And in a way, it puts the onus or the responsibility on me to then, in a new configuration of people, to have the discussions with the new people based on what I've learned about myself from the reflection and from the work that I've done previously. It doesn't necessarily have to be a facilitated process all the time, right? It can be just part of normal working together is we have a new team. Let me have a coffee with this person and understand what works for them and what doesn't. And I can share what works and what doesn't for me. And then we can figure out if we need to make any agreements to make it better. You know, so that might actually be, you know, done in an hour coffee where I get to know the person a little bit better. And all of a sudden we know how to work together also.
Yeah. And I think that's also relates to what you said earlier, that most organizations, especially those who work in an agile way, they have standards for that.
Mm-hmm.
So if everyone knows that, okay, if you're joining a new team or that these sorts of self-reflection are part of the process, then it also becomes a ritual where everyone speaks the same language and knows what they refer to. It was with Lizette Southerns that I had a conversation. She referred to the manual. So how can we have a manual of ourselves, how we function, and share this with our team members and how important it is for remote teams?
The manual of me.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's actually a great image and a great tool to use. You can put whatever questions you think are relevant in there. I like that a lot as well. But it can't stand there, right? I can't just, you know, write it all down and then think it's done. I need to have the interaction about it.
Upload it on the internet. Exactly. Let the magic happen.
Exactly. Now that you know how to work with me, let's go.
Yeah, which brings us back to the topic of agency and responsibility, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Wow. Thank you, Stefan.
Thank you, Miriam.
We've spoken for, almost 1.5 hours. Is there anything that you would have wanted to share, but we didn't? I'm aware that there were a lot of topics that we intended to.
Let's look at the parking lot.
Is there anything that you wanted to share with me in the audience before we part?
Nothing comes to mind that we haven't touched on anyway. Yeah, it was a lot of fun. Time flies when you're having a good conversation.
Thank you. I will put your contact details and how to reach you in the show notes.
Perfect. Thank you.
Radical inclusion.
Radical inclusion.
Thank you for staying tuned and for listening until the very end. I hope that you found the inspiration and the wisdom that you are looking for. And I hope that you will subscribe to the show so that you never miss any of the interviews with another inspiring facilitator from across the world. I'm devoted to continue this podcast and to deliver weekly an episode that maintains the quality that you expect and you deserve. And if you would like to help me to maintain this quality and to keep the podcast free, please help us. Visit workshops.org/support to make a small donation to keep the podcast free. Thank you so much. I hope to be in your ears next week.